Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in veterinary neurology, Peter Smith. Thank you, Peter. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, everybody, and thanks for joining us this lunchtime. What we find nowadays is that with the availability of mobile phones, people are increasingly turning up to consultations with video footage of peculiar episodes that animals are having. And we're increasingly getting advice requests based on similar videos that are presented to people in practice a lot as well. What I thought would be quite useful would be to try and go through the sort of range of conditions that can occur and that we're presented with, and also try and put it into what, to my mind, is a reasonably logical order, so that you can develop a relatively rational way of looking at these things, which will help you to decide what the next stage of investigations might be. Okay, so as a neurologist, most of the time, what I'm confronted by is an animal with a neurological problem. That can be anything from lameness to ataxia to stumbling over to one side to peculiar behavior, all sorts of different things. And the question that I'm asking myself when I perform the examination is, first of all, do I really think this animal has a neurological problem? And if so, what's the site of that lesion? And I come to that conclusion by doing a whole variety of different neurological tests. I think, as you know, there are three basic types of neurological tests. You can do reflex tests, such as the patellar tendon reflex and other myotatic reflexes in the limbs, the withdrawal reflex in the limbs, perineal reflex, cutaneous truncal reflex, the various cranial nerve reflexes and responses that you see in the brain as well. So we look at them, we look at the postural reactions, which is illustrated by that cartoon of a chap standing on one leg. What you're testing when you do this is you're testing the connection between the sensory information in the foot, and you're testing whether that's going all the way up to the brain. The brain's then recognizing that the foot is in a slightly odd position, and it's making a decision to put it into a more appropriate position. So that information's got to go all the way back from the brain, down the spinal cord, down the motor nerves, and the foot has got to move back into a normal position. So when you're testing conscious proprioception, and when you're looking at postural responses, you're testing quite a complex array of different neurological structures there that gives you information about how well the nervous system is working. You can also test, obviously we don't normally do anything as subtle as tickling dogs' feet with feathers, but what we do is pinch their toes and look at the response. You're not just looking at the response in the limb there, so you're not just looking at the withdrawal reflex, you're also looking at whether the animal has a conscious perception of whether the animal is painful, which is obviously particularly important in animals that present paralyzed, because obviously whether they can feel makes a big difference to their prognosis. And so broadly, with these three different categories of tests, what you're doing is you put them together in a puzzle and you try and work out which bits of the nervous system are working normally, which bits aren't working normally, and on the basis of that, you should be able to come up with a site for the neurological lesion. So the primary aim of all of that is to come up with a single lesion site, a single lesion that explains all the deficits that you see. So obviously in that cartoon that's illustrated on the slide there, you've got a lesion in the midsection of the spinal cord between T3 and L3. So you'd expect that animal to have impaired postural responses in its pelvic limbs, normal spinal reflexes in all four limbs, and normal cranial nerve reflexes. And it's just by doing that examination that you can focus attention, you can draw up a list of differential diagnoses based on that localization, and you can decide which diagnostic tests to do. Some circumstances, it's just not possible to do that. Sometimes you have an array of neurological deficits that you cannot explain by a single lesion site. And it's those cases, and they're relatively rare, but it's those cases where you have to, you reach the conclusion that you have a multifocal disease. And actually by identifying that, you already dramatically shorten down your list of differential diagnoses and alter the range of diagnostic tests that you might do. So it's still useful information, and it's just helping you to decide where to go next. However, there's this big group of neurological conditions, and probably an expanding group actually from the perspective of the sort of cases that I see. This big group of cases where animals just have sporadic problems, intermittent problems. I guess one of the more common ones, the common causes of a sporadic abnormality, would be dogs with pain. Now, sometimes pain can be a persistent thing. You can have animals that are in chronic pain and they're continually uncomfortable. But the nature of neurological pain is that it can be surprisingly sporadic. So what that picture illustrates is a dog with neck pain. And it's painful because it's got a disc prolapse, and that prolapse disc is putting pressure on the spinal cord. It's pinching the nerve roots and it's aggravating the meninges. And you might imagine that that dog is going to be painful all the time, but actually they can potter along quite happily when they're moving sometimes. And then they can suddenly do something relatively minor. And they can be screaming in pain. So the pain can be very severe when it occurs, but it can be remarkably sporadic. So you can have these episodes that will last anything from 30 seconds to a couple of hours, and then the dog will go out for a walk and it'll be perfectly happy again. So that for me is one of the key things that you get with neurological pain, is that it can be very severe when it occurs, but it can be surprisingly sporadic as well. One of the other problems that you can have that occurs sporadically is ataxia and incoordination. And again, this is something that you'll see in dogs where they can be permanently ataxic and incoordinated. But occasionally you'll get specific syndromes where you can have a dog that walks along perfectly normally most of the time, but will then start to appear incoordinated. I guess a good example of that is the episodic ataxia that's described in Labradors, for which there's a specific genetic abnormality being identified. And in these dogs, they can walk along quite happily, but if they exercise for around about 10 minutes in a lot of cases, they start to become very, very incoordinated and weak in their back legs. Weakness and collapse is also often an intermittent problem. I guess good examples of an episodic weakness, the classic example I suppose would be myasthenia gravis, where you have a dog that is normal but then gets a progressive weakness the more exercise that it does. And this can vary anything, this can be something that occurs within a few steps, but it can sometimes take quite a bit more exercise than that before they start to show signs of weakness. But there are a lot of other neurological problems where you'll get weakness occurring intermittently. Another very good example of a sporadic neurological problem is seizures. And also the wide array of probably non-seizure muscle spasms that we see in cases now. And that's becoming an increasingly large component of what we do, is dealing with these cases. Looking at them, trying to work out, is it a weakness, is it a muscle spasm, or is it a genuine seizure? And hopefully that's what we'll manage to achieve by going through today. And the other thing that we see is odd behaviour. So this can be anything from dogs chasing their legs, chasing their tails, sorry, to perhaps doing fly catching or lying there staring up at the stars, or other various sort of peculiar learned stereotypical behaviours that we see from time to time. I'm not going to focus quite so much on them because they're a little bit less common and rather difficult to be precise about what the nature of the problem is in a lot of cases. So, sporadic problems. What you're doing with any neurological problem, this is the sort of algorithm that I would use if I'm looking at a case with neurological disease. I'm doing a general clinical examination, combining that with the results of my neurological examination and what I know from the history. And I'm using that to try and establish a sensible differential diagnosis list based on what sort of dog it is, how quickly the problem has come on, when it has the problem, and also the findings of my neurological examination, which hopefully tells me whether I do have a lesion or not. And I can then go on and decide to do hopefully some sensible diagnostic tests, so I'm not just doing every test under the sun. But the nature of the sporadic problem is that the results of the clinical examination and the neurological examination are often normal, which leaves me relying increasingly heavily on the history to generate a sensible differential diagnosis list. And increasingly, this is starting to involve videos. If you haven't got a video, you can still get a lot of good information, but you need to spend time with the client and you need to question them carefully. You need to work out what time episodes are happening. Is it exercise associated? Is it more common during the night? Is it more common during daytime? Is it when they're confronted by food? Is it after food? Is it when they get stressed? How long do the episodes go on for? Is there a pre-ictal period which you might get with a seizure? Is there a post-ictal period which you might get with a seizure, but perhaps not some of the other episodes? And also look at the clinical features of it. Is it a muscle spasm? Is it a muscle weakness? Do they appear to be uncoordinated? Are they showing any other signs, any autonomic signs, for example? Are they being sick? Are they passing feces? Are they passing urine? Are they salivating a lot? I think all of these factors, you can get a lot from just talking to people and listening to them. But you can get a huge amount of help by having a good quality video. Now, I'm often quite impressed with the quality of the video that we can see. So this is unprompted. This is a video provided by a client, which is done really, really well. It shows you just exactly the sort of thing you want to do. So this dog has a slightly bizarre problem. It's got a fairly subtle muscle tremor. So he's keeping the camera still. You can see some fairly subtle movements of the ear, subtle involuntary movements of the ear here. And if you look carefully in the cheek muscles, you can see some sort of muscle fasciculations going on there. So the good thing here is he's keeping the video still. He's at a sensible distance from the dog. And it enables you to pick up really quite subtle things. So you can see all this twitching of the whiskers here as well. So you've got these sort of muscle fasciculations going on right across just the one side of this dog's head. And the owner making the video is just doing a really good job of keeping the camera still, keeping it at a sensible distance, and showing the salient features. So that, for me, that's a perfect owner video, really. Unfortunately, a lot of the time, what we're confronted by is something a little bit more like this. And I can understand why people make this sort of video, because they're very distressed by seeing their dog in what they think of as distress. In this one, they're moving the camera around. They're not focusing on the dog. They're moving it from side to side. I have no idea. It's too short to really get an appreciation of what's going on. I don't know whether that's a dog that's playing. I don't know whether it's in pain. I don't know whether it can't get up and whether it's got muscle spasm. But really, it's a bit hopeless. You get far more out of a consultation where you're simply asking questions about that case. So the nature of the video is important, and it really helps if people can just take the time, stand back a little bit, which obviously goes against the grain because they want to help their dog. But if they can just stand back, keep the camera steady, and just enable you to be the observer of what's happening in that episode. So if anyone's ever talking about an episodic problem, get them to video it, but just give them a few bit of basic pointers so that you can actually make some helpful interpretations. And you want a bit of video that's 30 seconds to 60 seconds. You want 2 hours, you don't want 5 seconds. So one of the big things we're trying to distinguish in these videos is very often whether you're dealing with a genuine seizure or something like a movement disorder. Now, I'm not going to talk about this in detail. It's just to give a bit of an illustration of the complexity of voluntary movement. So you have these structures in the slightly more primitive parts of the forebrain, which in human patients, they tend to refer to them as the basal ganglia. Strictly speaking, they're basal nuclei, which is actually the term that we tend to use in veterinary medicine. But they're the same structures, and dogs and humans have this similar sort of range of structures. They're developed to different degrees in people, but they're still there, and they still have a similar range of integrations. So you have the decision to move starting off in the cortex, that's then feeding down into this complex of basal nuclei. And then you have slightly different pathways that loop back round, they output from there through the thalamus back up to the motor cortex before you then initiate the movement. So it's quite complicated. And you have some fairly complex feedback loops between these different different structures within the basal nuclei. And if you look at the diagram, you can see there's some arrows, there's various excitatory and inhibitory inputs and outputs from these different structures. And there's also modulatory inputs, and I guess the best known of those is probably the dopaminergic input into the striatum from the substantia nigra, which is what's disturbed in Parkinson's disease. So I don't want to go into detail about this, but it's just to illustrate that it's a complex system, is voluntary movement. And it's perhaps not surprising that that there's a lot of things that can go wrong here, and they can manifest themselves in a variety of different ways that result in some very bizarre syndromes, and they can look very seizure-like. So with this video here, you're trying to work out whether this is a seizure. And I think most of you will have come across this sort of thing before. This is a fairly classic seizure. This is a dog that's starting off with what appears to be a focal component, and then pretty rapidly progresses to lying on its side, going through its tonic phase, and now progressing to a clonic phase where it looks like it's running on its side. It's unconscious. It's affecting the whole body. It's self-limiting. So here we are, probably about a minute into that episode. And he's gradually starting to recover. So it's all over with fairly quickly. Very severe, very distressing to witness. This is a great video because this owner must have seen this dog do this several times before, because it's fantastic for them to be able to have the presence of mind to take a step back and illustrate what's happening properly. But that's a really good video that's really helpful to classify what type of seizure the dog is having, and also to illustrate a classic seizure. So this in some ways starts off looking fairly similar. It's a much younger Labrador, this one. It's outside. But you can immediately see it looks slightly different. Now, seizures can manifest themselves in different ways. You can't categorically say that this isn't a seizure. I suppose I look at that dog, and I'm sure you're doing the same thing. You're looking at it and thinking, is that a seizure, or is it really conscious? It certainly has involuntary muscle spasm, and it's incoordinated. It can't stand up. Looks like it's trying to. It looks like it has a degree of recognition of its surroundings. And I think you get these episodes in dogs from time to time, and people will generally think that their dogs are conscious and will think that they are trying to interact, but they just physically can't. It's very difficult to say that that's not a seizure, though. My view is it's probably not a seizure. It's probably a derangement within the basal nuclei. But actually, I can't prove that. What this video shows is this is an experimental video. So this shows some I'm just going to pause that a sec. So what we've just looked at there is one where you're seeing a classic seizure, another one where we're seeing what is clearly muscle spasm, and what I would be inclined to classify as probably a movement disorder, probably a dyskinesia, involuntary muscle spasm, but not a genuine seizure. The reason I'm showing this next video is it's some experimental mice, and it shows you what are these mice are having seizures, but they're having seizures of different severity, and that severity scale is graded on a Racine scale from 1 to 5. So you can see the moderate scale here. So this is the midpoint, and it's not dramatically different actually from what you're seeing in those dogs where they're thrashing around. It looks like it's interacting with its environment. There's clearly a problem because it has that spasm there and it's rearing up on its back legs. And it's only when you get to the slightly more severe end of the scale that it becomes more recognizable as what we would all view as a classical seizure. So here it's starting to rear up and fall backwards slightly. And then as you progress onto the top level of the scale, you have more your classic generalized tonic-clonic seizure that we see in a lot of epileptic dogs and dogs with structural brain disease. So the point of putting that in is just is to illustrate really that we don't that I don't know for sure that dogs that are having these muscle spasms are not having a sort of mild generalized seizure. It could be a seizure. But my view is it's probably more likely to be a derangement of the basal nuclei. But that's just an opinion. So how do we go about distinguishing movement disorders, dyskinesias from genuine seizures? Well, I suppose one of the things, this is not a great way of distinguishing it, but we certainly see that some breeds are predisposed to these sort of episodic muscle spasms that we might class as dyskinesias. So this is one example, the collapsing cavalier, illustrated by the laughing cavalier here, which of course you might know from your art history, or perhaps from drinking lots of McEwan's, because it forms the backdrop to their marketing. So this is a syndrome of episodic collapse and muscle spasm that's been recognized in Cavalier King Charles Spaniels for quite a long time. The dog you're watching is this one here. And this is an episodic thing that tends to happen at exercise. They're perfectly normal if they're just walking along. They're perfectly normal pottering about the garden. But when they do a bit of exercise, they get themselves into this peculiar posture. They sort of have a dystonia, an uncontrolled contraction of a muscle, of opposing muscle groups. And sometimes you see this very characteristic picking the gait up very high and a slightly, rather a hunched back as well. You'll note actually that this dog has perhaps learned that it doesn't want to run about, because the more it runs about, the more it's going to spasm. And actually, in some cases, there is a suggestion that these dogs will tend to learn that it's more sensible to be quiet because they're less likely to have an episode. So that's a collapsing cavalier, and this is quite an interesting syndrome, really. And the genetic trigger for this has been identified now. I'll just put that running for a second. This illustrates it again. It's often difficult to catch good quality videos of these. Having spent the last 10 minutes complaining about the quality of owner videos, these are videos that I've made, and it's still very difficult to capture what the genuine abnormality is. So you can see there the dog's walking along perfectly normally. Then you start to get a bit overexcited, tire it out a little bit, run it around with some helpful students. And it's really only when it starts to, we carried on doing that for a little bit longer, and then it's more obvious when it got into the grass that it looks very hypermetric and rather tense, and it's not dramatic, it's not quite as badly affected as the previous dog, but you can see that that very dysmetric way it's using its legs. There's muscle spasm there that's not well controlled, but not quite as bad as the previous one. So this is triggered by exercise, stress, excitement. And as I say, some dogs seem to learn that if they keep calmer, they're less likely to be affected. So there are some dogs who can be several years old before it becomes apparent that there is a genuine problem. Yet it is a genetic mutation, and it's in a protein called Brevocan, which is an extracellular proteoglycan, and it forms these sort of nets around about synaptic endings and is supposed to affect synaptic transmission. And it's amazing that single genetic abnormality can lead to that exercise or stress-induced dystonia. So that's one good example. Another example illustrated here by this Border Terrier on, well, what's not currently the wall, but it's sitting on, I'm sure those of you, there will be a few people out there who will recognize this as being part of Hadrian's Wall. That's the famous tree from what's his name? Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, where they seem to manage to implausibly get from the south coast of England up to the Scottish border nearly within about 24 hours of walking. Anyway, there is this syndrome of intermittent muscle spasm that you get in Border Terriers as well. So here's a video of a Border Terrier having some muscle spasm. You can see he's uncoordinated. Looks like he's trying to do something, but he just can't. There's an attempt at voluntary movement there, but there's too much spasm going on in the legs and this truncal sway. And he's got enough sense to realise that his best place at the moment is to get himself back in bed, if he can manage it. So that was recognised a few years ago as it's been called various things. It's been called epileptiform cramping. It's been called Spike's disease after an owner who identified it in their dog called Spike. But it's a syndrome that we see it's not common, but there's certainly a predilection for it in Border Terriers. And it's a nasty thing to have. This is something that won't go on for 30 seconds or a minute. It can be relatively brief, but in some cases they can go on for an awful long time, sometimes up to 2 hours or even longer sometimes. They tend not to be able to walk, although they'll try to, and it might, like that dog did, trying to get itself off the bed. They appear to be conscious, and it's limb spasm, and it's truncal muscle spasm, and it's like a very coarse tremor. And you'll sometimes get wind, borborygmi, which owners will comment on in probably about 50% of cases. And as I say, this is probably due to abnormalities in the basal nuclei, but I don't know that for sure. It's just speculation, really. One of the things that has been suggested is that there may be an association with anti-gliadin antibodies. So this is a study that one of my colleagues that I used to work with here, actually, Mark Lowry, he did in a small group of dogs and demonstrated that they had these anti-gluten antibodies, and that actually by putting the dogs onto a gluten-free diet, the frequency of episodes that they were having decreased, and that coincided with them having a reduction in the level of antibodies in those cases as well. That does not prove that it's it's anything to do with the gluten hypersensitivity, but there was an association in that group of dogs that raised the possibility that there may be a contribution from that. So we don't know for sure that that means it causes it, but there certainly seems to be this, you would certainly observe that some dogs will tend to improve if you put them onto a gluten-free diet, sometimes onto other diets as well. And that's probably your better approach to dealing with these cases is to go for a change of diet. Now, the reason you think about these is perhaps representing disorders of the basal nuclei rather than genuine forebrain abnormalities that you have in dogs with seizures is largely borrowed from what we know from people. So I'm not going to go through a whole list of these, but this is one example of an abnormality of the basal nuclei that you see in kids sometimes. And this will tend to follow. This is a syndrome that follows beta hemolytic strep infection, and it can happen quite some time after they've had infection. And it's presumed to be an immune-mediated disorder. You get antibodies interfering with the complex control of movement within the complex of basal nuclei. And it's called Sydenham's chorea. It's been called St. Vitus's Danth in the past, classically. And you can see the sort of subtleties that you get if you look at the video. So this lad here, he's got chorea. So he's got this sort of dancing, twitchy movements of his shoulders and of his hands. And this is because of a disorder in the basal nuclei. He's still conscious, he knows what he's doing, he can respond to commands and instructions, but he's got these various peculiar twitchy movements, things like this, and tongue fasciculations. He can't keep his shoulders still. And the bilismus is sort of throwing his arms around slightly uncontrollably. So I'm going to stop that, I don't think we need to carry on with that. So that's an illustration of how complex the basal nuclei can be. This is meant to show the same thing. So this is a chap with Parkinson's disease. So Parkinson's, as you know, also you can probably remember, is where you have, you start to lose, well, you lose all sorts of neurons actually, but it starts off predominantly affecting dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra. And that's one of the modulatory regions for the basal nuclei. So what you see, you've got this chap here with Parkinson's disease. One of the classic things you see is the coarse tremor at rest. And they're hypokinetic. It's difficult for them to initiate movement. This is not a lack of strength. You note the way that she's putting her foot there. And there are it's a very peculiar condition. You can people have done things where they'll. I'm just going to pause that a second. You can do peculiar things like you can draw lines on the ground, or you can paint some steps on the ground. And whereas that chap can't walk in a normal corridor, sometimes if you have them presented by a painting of a stepladder on the ground, they're able to step and walk much better. And then. This is the same guy taken outside and put on a bike, which is a pretty brave thing to do for someone who is fundamentally hypokinetic and can barely walk. But I think what it illustrates is that movement is complex, and the way that we initiate movement is very complex. And you can understand how derangements in the basal nuclei can have a huge variety of different abnormal movements and can manifest themselves in very many different ways. And he glides gently to a halt. Oop, and off he gets. And suddenly, now he's dismounted, he can't move again because he can't initiate movement, he can't start walking. So he's back to shuffling again. So that's not directly relevant to the talk, but I think what it is it's really illustrative of how complex the basal nuclei actually are and why it is that you can see such a wide range of abnormalities in people and dogs where you think you have basal nuclei abnormalities. Of course, does it really matter whether it's a seizure or not? That's the key thing. You've got to, if you're presented with a dog like this, does it matter if it's a seizure or whether it's a movement disorder, a dyskinesia? You're still talking about diseases that can affect the forebrain. It's just the part of the forebrain that's affected. It's slightly different in the two areas. It's cerebral cortex for a seizure, basal nuclei for your movement disorders. So the range of diseases that you can look for is probably broadly very, very similar. Actually, it does matter because whereas with a seizure, they tend to respond quite well to anti-seizure medication. Actually, for a lot of these movement disorders, they tend not to. There are some reports of the Border Terriers with their muscle spasm improving when they're treated with phenobarbitone, but certainly my impression is that they don't do terribly well. And so you can find yourself making an assumption that you have a seizure activity and treating with anti-seizure medication, and then it doesn't work. So you end up lurching either from one anti-seizure medication to another, or sometimes incorporating several at the same time, and you start to run the risk of creating a whole load of side effects without having any beneficial impact at all. So it is quite useful, I think, to be able to distinguish these and hopefully therefore predict whether anti-seizure medication is going to be really helpful. So this is where we come to what I view as, this is me trying to have a slightly rational approach when I look at these videos. And how do I distinguish these things? And I don't mean just seizures versus dyskinesias. I mean also other types of condition as well. So one of the first questions you might want to ask if you see an animal that's seizuring or spasming is whether or not it's conscious when it's having that episode. Now, if you're confronted by something like this, the collapsed classic elderly boxer, which is found collapsed and seizuring here, I don't think there are many people who are going to argue that that dog is conscious while it's having that episode. So it's unconscious, it's got widespread muscle activity. That, for me, is much more likely to be a genuine seizure. It's something that's affecting the cerebral cortex rather than just causing involuntary muscle spasm. A little bit more difficult in this case, so there you've clearly got a dog that's not normal, seems to have some involuntary muscle spasm, but actually it looks like it's probably responding to the owner, so that dog probably is conscious. So I think knowing whether a dog is conscious when it's having an episode like this is really quite helpful. So that for me looks much more like what I would consider to be a dyskinesia, a dystonia. It's not a genuine seizure. So not so likely to respond to anti-seizure medication. You see these dogs as well from time... Oh, sorry, that's the wrong one. You see this type of thing from time to time as well, this episodic head nodding, which I guess you could view as a coarse tremor. You get some dogs that will say no, you get some dogs that will say yes. And actually, usually these dogs can be distracted if that owner who's standing next to the dog there calls the dog's name. In a lot of cases, they'll come over to them. It doesn't seem to bother them. I think they're probably conscious and aware of their surroundings. Now, my inclination would be to say that's probably not a genuine seizure. However, there are some people who've done some research that has suggested that it could well be a genuine seizure. It doesn't prove it. You could certainly say that they don't seem to respond particularly well to anti-seizure medication. And actually, it's probably, in my view, probably be best viewed as just being a benign episodic head tremor. But there is still debate as to whether it could be a seizure or whether it's not. Another thing that's quite useful is to look and see whether you have some consistent lateralization of abnormalities during the episode. So that's illustrated by this video, I think. So what you've got here, this is a dog that's, this, I'll tell you straight out, this dog's having seizures. But if you watch it at the start, it's not having seizures all the time, but it's doing these sorts of episodes quite a lot. So it's twisting round to the right-hand side. So it's having its muscle spasm, and it's twisting round to that side. It becomes obvious that it's a seizure because of what it actually progresses on to become. You can see this spontaneous activity around about the head muscles, the ears are twitching, and then it starts to topple over to one side. And then gradually it starts to turn into more your sort of classical seizure. Now, if it didn't have that period where it turns into a classical generalized tonic-clonic seizure towards the end, if you're just seeing the bit at the beginning, all you've got to go on is that involuntary activity. But the fact that it's affecting consistently the same part, the same side of the dog, makes me a bit more suspicious that it's probably going to have, well, firstly, that it might have a structural brain lesion, and secondly, that it's more likely to be the cerebral cortex that's affected. This shows the same thing again, really. So you've got this dog which is not having seizures all the time. It's just having episodes like this where it goes... bit peculiar, and you can see the, you know, it's involuntary muscle spasm, it's affecting the side of its head, and then it seems to recover and go back to normal. I've spliced these together, they're taken at different times, but it's the same thing again, twisting around to that side, and each episode is very, very similar. So in that case, it's a seizure, and we know it's a seizure because it turns into a classical seizure. But if you're just seeing the focal bit at the beginning, it can be difficult to distinguish. But if it's happening in the same direction and to the same side every time, then you might be more suspicious of it being a genuine seizure. This, for me, is probably more likely a dyskinesia, a dystonia. It's not the perfect video, partly because there's a finger in the way, but the camera's staying still. And you can see that the dog is, you know, it's able to stand up and it's able to, it looks like it has some awareness of its surroundings. And yet it's got some involuntary muscle spasm on this side, and then it alternates to affect the other side as well. And you'll see this in these syndromes, I think, where you don't just have muscle spasms on one side of the body, perhaps spreading into a generalized seizure and affecting all sides of the body. You can, the muscle spasms can sort of wander around, they'll affect different legs. On one occasion, it might be a left front leg. It could be a left front leg and a left back and a right back leg at the same time. It can be one front leg and then it can be the other front leg. So there's a variety. I think there are just clues in the episodes when you see them that suggest that this is uncoordinated muscle spasm that's arising sort of diffusely within movement centers, but it's not really a proper seizure. So for me, that would be a lot more suspicious a dystonia. The other thing that I think is helpful to distinguish is whether you do have genuine uncontrolled muscle spasm. And that can be surprisingly difficult to distinguish from other conditions, such as a reluctance to move, perhaps because an animal's painful. So what you've got here is a pug. And we occasionally, not so commonly, but we occasionally see these sort of muscle spasms in pugs as well. So you've got that truncal ataxia there, almost a, again, almost a bit of a sort of coarse tremor affecting his head. His uncoordinated walking because he just hasn't got the muscle control that he needs to walk in a normal manner. So you look carefully, the dog's conscious, it's trying to do normal doggy things, it's reacting to an owner. It can walk, but it just can't walk normally because it's got this muscle spasm and this sort of truncal ataxia and coarse tremor affecting it. So that for me is looking a lot more like the sort of episodic dystonia dyskinesia. You compare that with this video here. There are similarities. It does look different. You've got a dog that looks kind of similar. It wants to walk. It's conscious. It's trying to do normal doggy things. Doesn't quite have the same truncal ataxia that you had before, but it's got the slightly bizarre stance, odd muscle spasm. And he sets off. So he's conscious, so doesn't look like a seizure. But he's certainly not moving normally. And actually that dog has a cervical disc extrusion. And the reason it's getting into those funny postures and the reason it doesn't want to walk around is because it has a very painful neck. So you need to look carefully and ask yourself whether you're really looking at something, you know, is consciousness normal? Is there lateralization? Is there a muscle spasm there? Or is it just because the dog doesn't want to walk because it's sore somewhere? Excuse me. The other thing that's obviously going to be helpful sometimes is that you do get, sometimes we'll see neurological abnormalities that give you a clue as to the problem. Now, I'd be cheating a little bit if we went back to having abnormalities on the static examination because we're trying to talk about episodic problems. So this is not common, but this is an illustration of a dog that was having episodic collapse. So this dog is almost completely normal when you examine it neurologically. There is one key abnormality, but it was having these episodes when it was exercised. We had to run it probably for about 5 minutes, and then suddenly it would develop this marked nystagmus, which you can see quite clearly. So the slow phase in one direction and the fast phase, fast return. And that would resolve after approximately a minute, and the dog would go back to being okay again. And then if we exercise it again, it would do exactly the same thing again. It would develop these acute vestibular signs. Now, I confessed I was cheating slightly, because that dog does have an abnormality when it's examined. All its postural responses are normal. That's normal. That's fine. But it had a facial paralysis. So it's got episodic vestibular signs where it would develop a nystagmus and develop a vestibular ataxia when it was exercised. And the only abnormality that we had in that case was a facial neuropathy. And actually, by taking that, you can make up a logical reason why that would happen, albeit slightly difficult to actually prove it. But that's probably an intermittent hyperexcitability of the vestibular cochlear nerve triggered by changes during exercise. And it's something that you can see from time to time. You get these episodic vestibular problems described in people, but rarely, and not really recognized in dogs, but it can happen. The static examination gives you a bit of a clue because it illustrates that there's a problem in the region of the facial nerve. There's something wrong there. But actually, you get your clue by looking at the dog when it's having an episode. The other thing that's quite helpful is trying to work out whether you've got any associated triggers. When it's occurring, is it occurring when it's asleep? when it's asleep? Is it occurring when it's relaxing? Is it occurring when it's exercised or stressed or confronted by food or after food? Good example of this, you've probably seen this sort of thing before, but I just find this one of the most extraordinary stories, that these goats seem to have been bred specifically for this. So this is in the States, and they look pretty normal, but as soon as you get them to move suddenly, give them a shock, this is what happens. This almost looks like it's a bit made up. Every time I look at this, I think it looks fake, but it's not. So what's happening is that their muscles are going to contract, but they then can't relax again. So they're ending up with a sudden acute rigid hyperextension of the limbs, and so they fall over. And that's myotonia. So in myotonia, you have a failure of relaxation. If you let your muscles warm up, then do things very slowly, then you can walk okay. But if you suddenly get a shock, I've seen this in cats, and you get it in dogs sometimes as well. If a cat jumps down from a chair, they can jump down, but then they suddenly land, and actually the sudden muscle use that comes from landing means that all the muscles go rigid, and then they'll suddenly topple over. So in this case, you've got a very marked movement stimulated muscular problem. And it's recognizing that's a failure of relaxation, and that probably points you in the direction of neuromuscular problems. So, and you do see that in cats and dogs as well sometimes. This is another good illustration of an episode triggered by exercise. So this is a dog that first started having, I saw last week, started having problems about 6 weeks ago. This is an owner video, shows it very nicely. He's standing still, letting the dog do his thing. Dog's completely normal in all respects, except for this. Then he started doing this when they were taking him out for walks. So he's walking along there quite happily, seems to be walking normally. Cheerful chap. And then he has that funny little episode where he collapses. Or spasms. So I guess you sort of go back to the whole basic approach. He looks like he's conscious there. It doesn't look like there's an obvious lateralization of what's going on. I'm going to play it again because I think it's quite interesting. So you're then trying to work out, does it look like a muscle spasm? Certainly doesn't look painful to me, that one. But like there's spasm there. It looks like it's toppling over to one side. And then perhaps the other side as well. So it's not really lateralized. It just looks like he suddenly becomes weak. And then he's back to normal again. Which is what happened in that case. So that dog, when I saw that dog, I measured his blood glucose and it was about 4.7, which is of course normal. And then we took him out for a bit of a walk around, not particularly vigorous, for about 5 or 10 minutes. Brought him back in again and his blood glucose was down to 2. And we then measured his glucose and did it with a paired insulin sample and found that he had a very, very abnormally elevated insulin concentration and persistently low, well, not persistently low, an exercise-associated hypoglycemia. And in fact, he has an insulinoma and had surgery actually just this week, and he's had his insulinoma removed. So I guess one of the things that makes this case rather complex, this dog initially actually came to see one of my colleagues and it had an episode of collapse when it saw them, and it actually had seizure activity as well. So it collapsed and it had involuntary, it started to have a focal seizure affecting its head. And so it was passed on to me primarily to have investigations for seizures. And obviously the route that we typically go down that with that would be to do a blood test and then to do an MRI scan of the brain and take a sample of spinal fluid if that seemed appropriate. But actually, I think by looking at the video and watching what it's doing and recognizing that it's tending to occur most, it didn't just happen when it was at exercise. It did happen when it was excited a couple of times. And if you look carefully at what it's doing, it's not just that it's having a seizure. It's becoming weak. And okay, on a couple of occasions, it has become weak and it's progressed on and had a seizure. But it's by thinking about that carefully and thinking about the sort of things that can cause that, that enables you to avoid spending what could have been a fortune on an MRI scan and not getting a diagnosis. And actually just doing a few blood glucoses, recognizing that there's a problem, identifying that he's got a tumor and being able to remove it surgically and saving the owner an awful lot of money and perhaps enabling it to have a surgery, which it might not otherwise have had. So it is worth taking time to question people very carefully about what they're dealing with and also to look very critically at a video and trying to be sensible and rational in your approach to these cases. This is another collapse at exercise case. No prizes for recognising that this is a different condition, because I wouldn't put two up that are the same. But it just show you that they can start to look quite similar. This dog's probably been walking for about I don't know, 5 or 10, 5 minutes or so. Doesn't seem to be ataxic or uncoordinated. Interacting, looking pretty normal, behaving pretty normally. Perhaps not quite as excitable as your normal Weimaraner. And then as we get to here, suddenly starts to go. So that's a fairly dramatic collapse. He starts to go on his back legs. It's a bit of a shame we don't see more of it because you don't get a chance to evaluate whether that looks like it's turning into seizure activity or whether there's any spontaneous muscle activity there at all. But I think I'm just going to go back briefly to that last little bit there. When he goes, he suddenly looks like he becomes very weak and collapses down. And actually, in that case, I suppose what's your differential diagnosis there? You could imagine, you can't rule out that he's hypoglycemic. So you'd have to look at that. Could be, suddenly using up what glucose he has available. You'd have to have myasthenia gravis on your differential diagnosis list, although he doesn't behave quite typically for that. Actually, what he had was he had an aortic thrombus. So what he has is a genuine claudication, he's managing to cope, he's presumably exercising anaerobically for that period that he's walking there, and then he's getting to the point where he has no energy supply left in his back legs and everything is just collapsing suddenly. So there's a variety of different differential diagnoses there, but I think what you would say is it doesn't look like a muscle spasm. It looks like a collapse. So you've got to think of things that are going to suddenly interfere with muscle function rather than things that are triggering spontaneous muscle activity. Got another one here as well, actually. And then I think this is the last one that I'm going to show because we're drawing to a close here. But it's just a good illustration of recognizing a potential trigger for a dog. So this is a dog that was collapsing periodically at home. And there was not really an awful lot more history there. You couldn't be... We got some clues perhaps about the nature of the collapse, which is what prompted us to do this. So here you've got it, him wandering around the consulting room, looking, behaving like a normal dog. Seems to be interacting normally. Doesn't appear to be paraparetic or ataxic at all. There's no tremor there. Even something to eat. Looks like he's interested in his food. And now he's suddenly stopped. So something peculiar is happening here. And this matched the way it was described by the owner, that he would suddenly have these episodes where he'd become very quiet and then start to collapse. Now that doesn't look like a muscle spasm to me. It doesn't look lateralized at all. It looks like he's conscious because he was trying to follow the food, but I'm just going to bring it back quickly to here. So it all starts about here, when he's confronted by his food. Starts to become very wobbly. Looks like he's becoming weak. So it looks like his brain's working normally in some respects because he's aware that the food's been taken away and he's trying to follow it, but something's happening that's stopping him from being able to follow it normally. It's not a spasm, it's a sudden onset weakness. And actually that dog has narcolepsy, so that's one of the classic things you see, is that when they get excited, they can suddenly have these episodes of cataplexy, which is what that is, where you have a sudden loss of muscle tone. And in severe cases, you can almost put a snack track out where you have a line of food and you can watch dogs, and they will wander along and they'll eat one piece after another, and they'll get to a certain point and then they'll just collapse. So it's about recognizing all sorts of things, looking very carefully at the episode of collapse. I'm going to ignore that one because I think we're out of time. So it's you're trying to incorporate your video into your history. You listen to what the owners say. If they can't get video, try and direct them and say, well, try and get some video when it does this or when it does that, and try and think, get them to go away and really think about what it is that's triggering an episode of collapse. And then hopefully if you can put it all together, it helps you to recognize whether you've got a genuine seizure, is it muscle spasm, is it muscle weakness, and then you can start to draw up a sensible list of differential diagnosis, and it's that that's going to enable you to go on and hopefully do the right diagnostic test that will get you the answer that you're looking for. Okay, I think we're going to stop there. Probably overrun by a few minutes, but I'll try and take a couple of questions if anyone has anything. Thanks. Okay, there's no questions at the moment. If anybody would like to email in any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them. If anyone has any peculiar videos of this type, I'd be more than happy for them to look me up. I work at David's Veterinary Specialists. I'm sure you can find me on the web, and I'm happy to try and have a look at some. I won't necessarily get back to you immediately, but we do get videos for advice requests now, and it's always interesting to see them. So if you've got any queries that you'd like to email in, that's fine.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Peter for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.